in. Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, May the 9th, 2018, 5/9/18, 15 minutes past the hour, and we have got a guest this hour you are not going to want to miss for love nor money. This is a gentleman who I have wanted to have on this program since the beginning of this program. Now more than 12 years ago, can you believe it's taken us that long to get together? Now, before I tell you who this guest is, I want to let you know about next week, because we have our big, amazing guest list for the month of May. Coming up next Thursday, we have Marion Ross, the mother from the Happy Days television series. Mrs. Cunningham, Marion Ross, who has written a new book. She will talk about that. Happy My Days, Good, Bad, Happy, and the Other. Marion Ross, next Thursday at 12:10 p.m. Eastern Time. And next Wednesday at 1:10 p.m., we'll have one of our old friends who's been on this program several times, who we love every time they come on. You probably remember him best for his Emmy Award-winning portrayal as Lou Grant on the Mary Tyler Moore Show in the TV series Lou Grant. And he's been in countless movies and television series before and after, including Roots. Ed Asner will be with us next Wednesday, a week from today, 1:10 to 2 p.m. Now, that brings us to this hour's guest. As I say, this is a man who has led a very interesting life and continues to lead it. He was the star, one of the stars, of a number one television series, The Dukes of Hazzard, which I'm sure you all remember very well. He has served as a United States representative, a political career, and really kept the flame for the Dukes of Hazzard television series alive by going around the country to fan fests and meeting with people and even running his own shop at one point. And we're going to learn all about that from the man who portrayed Cooter on the Dukes of Hazzard, Ben Jones. Momentarily, we're going to bring him in, but we got so many requests for this morning, we had to do it. Probably, if not the most popular television theme song of all time, it's up there. Waylon Jennings, The Dukes of Hazzard.
Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw, been in trouble with the law since the day they was born. Straightening the curves, flattening the hills. Someday the mountain might get 'em, but the law never will. Making their way, the only way they know how. That's just a little bit more than the law will allow. Just a good old boy. Wouldn't change if they could. Fighting the system like a two modern day Robin Hood.
So glad to welcome to these microphones for the first time Ben Jones. Ben, how are you?
Scott, I'm hanging in like Gunga Din. Beautiful morning here in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. And I'm just delighted to be on with you. It makes me feel better. To hear that song, as a matter of fact.
Well, that's what I was going to add.
I had a nickel for every time I've sung that song or listened to it. It brings back great memories immediately. And I think the great thing about our show is we don't say it was the Dukes of Hazzard was a good show. The Dukes of Hazzard is a good show. It still has legs, as we say in show business. Still extremely popular, not just in the United States, but all over the world. And we've been the beneficiaries of that, those of us who were involved with the show. It's like never having to grow up.
You know, that show truly is evergreen. It is not of a time, and that's a great thing.
It's timeless. And if you look at the show, we live out in the country here in rural Virginia. If you look at The Dukes of Hazzard, it looks like it could have been filmed right here last week. We still drive old cars on dirt roads and wear, blue jeans and work shirts and ball caps and drive past farmhouses and country churches and dirt roads. And it's just timeless in a lot of ways. It doesn't seem to grow old because the elements of the Dukes of Hazzard are classic. It's sort of like I grew up in the 1940s watching, and we didn't have television, we didn't have electricity, but I'd see the movies with Gene Autry and Roy Rogers, what they call B-Westerns or Saturday Westerns at the movie house, and that same kind of show. The good guys win, nobody gets hurt, there's always a lot of slapstick comedy and great action and music and beautiful girls, the rancher's daughter or whatever. And that's what we did, and it's timeless. It's international too. It's been shown, I think, in over 50 countries now, and half a dozen languages. And this gets the same reaction all internationally.
You know, I give the Dukes of Hazzard credit for this, and one of our favorite guests until he left us, we had him on several times, was James Best.
Oh yeah.
Oh.
There's a good example of the things that, you know, this is astonishing to me, but you know, our show somehow was just politically incorrect, and the snobs all hated it. But James Best, had an astonishing career as an actor before the Dukes of Hazzard, as did Sorrel Book and Denver Pyle. Sorrel played Boss Hogg. Well, when Sorrel and Jimmy would get together and do Roscoe and Boss Hogg shtick, and they improvised a lot of it. It was just classically hilarious. Doing slapstick comedy, these great actors, you know, and Sorrel had played Shakespeare and sang opera and was a Yale School of Drama, and Jimmy had just such a remarkable career, hundreds of films before the Dukes of Hazzard. And yet, those guys who, you know, and we were the number one show on television for several years, those guys were never even nominated for an Emmy for comedy.
Horrible.
That we were sort of the redheaded stepchild of the television industry. They didn't understand why people loved it. And they, you know, those people would refer to the United States of America as the flyover country. That means, you know, that's that country down beneath them as they fly from Los Angeles to New York. But Guy Lombardo, the great band leader, says, you know, nobody likes our music but the people. And the people love the Dukes of Hazzard. In those days, there are only three networks. So we got ratings that don't exist anymore. Sometimes we have 30 to 40 million people a week watching the Dukes of Hazzard on Friday nights.
Well, what always amazed me about Sorrel and James Best on Dukes of Hazzard was the villains were the comedians.
Well, that slapstick, it was harmless. It was the Robin Hood thing, where the good guys were the outlaws because of the law there was crooked. But it was, you know, nobody ever got hurt on our show, really. I mean, you could fall off a cliff and have a truck land on top of you and just brush yourself off. Nobody bled. It was harmless in that way, and people got that it was all a fantasy place, much like those Westerns I watched when I was a kid. Nobody won. I mean, nobody got hurt. The good guys always won. And they always won because they did the right thing. They made the right moral choice, as Gene Autry and Roy Rogers, whom I just idolized, both of them, and got to meet Roy Rogers one time. So, but another story. But that's why it holds up so well and why it continues to be popular. The thing that people miss is family entertainment, where the whole family, I'm not got anything against anybody else, I love The Sopranos and stuff like that, you know, but a show where the whole family can pile up together, grandparents, grandchildren, the mother, the dad, cousins, and all of them just sit around the television for an hour and enjoy themselves as a family. And that's what happened with the Dukes. Families watched it together. And it was about a family, too, about a family hanging together under often tough circumstances. So I think that is, you know, the lasting value of it. And I knew that when people started coming to me, up to me, and even in Congress, and they said, you know, I used to watch this show with my parents, and now I watch it with my kids. And that's the greatest compliment you can get in show business. That means is just going on and on, that it is timeless.
You know, I remember when the Dukes of Hazzard was on, it was on Friday nights, that mm-hmm. some high schools moved their football games to Saturday night because people weren't coming.
Yeah, yeah, and that happened in the South, and if you move, because everybody, Jeff Foxworthy, a great comics friend of mine, he said, we thought it was a law down where we lived that you had to watch the Dukes of Hazzard at 8 o'clock on Friday night, because things would just stop, and people would go on, well, time for the Dukes, I'll see you later, and everybody would go in the house and watch the Dukes of Hazzard with their family. But that's a great column if you can football, high school football in the South postponed or moved to another day because of a television show. Yeah, that's a powerful thing.
When the show was number one, when there were only three networks, what was it like for you to walk around, go to the grocery store, go out in public?
Well, I think for all of us, I had worked as an actor. The show started filming in 1978, 40 years ago, and we're celebrating that anniversary this year. I had worked as an actor started at it in 1962 and started getting paid for it almost immediately. So I'd been at it for 15 years or so and done a lot of stuff, a lot of theater work, some films, some TV, a lot of commercials, the things that actors do to get by, you know, drove a truck and worked, waited tables and all. But, you know, it was unknown. But suddenly, when 40 million people a week are watching you, you become a public person. So, it was a radical change in my life, you know, to, as you say, to be spotted every, you know, oh, it's Cooter, you know. So it was a bit of an adjustment there. I mean, can turn your head if you let it, but, I never moved to Hollywood. I commuted from Georgia, and I lived out in the country, so the people I saw a lot were the people I saw every day, you know, had for years, and everybody knew me, and but it was a strange thing. I'd get on an airplane and spend the whole time, you know, the flight attendants would bring up things for me to sign from people on the plane. And that was a remarkable thing. And I sort of capitalized on that with a political career because people knew who I was. Or people thought they knew who I was, and it didn't hurt, you know, to have that sort of name recognition and face recognition when I entered politics. But my life did change for sure.
When you were growing up, did you always want to be an actor?
No, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And when you're a little kid, you don't realize that you might have certain talents. But my mom loved going to the movies. We didn't, as I say, we didn't have television. I'd spent the first 10, 12 years of my life without electricity or indoor plumbing in a railroad house by the tracks. But my mother's family, there were a lot of people in there who performed, a lot of musicians, and they were very outgoing. My father's family were much more stoic and quiet-lipped and weren't outgoing. But my mama's family were. There were performers there. They were very very talented people, and she encouraged that in me. And I just had a gift for it. I had a knack for it, and that didn't come out until I was in college. And a friend of mine asked me to be in a play. I'd never done any. I guess 20, 21 years old by that point, and had never been on stage. But I just took off, and then I felt, you know, had a passion for it then, and I decided that I wanted to pursue that. So it, you know, as I say, I'd worked for 15 years professionally before the Dukes came along, and I also had a talent for writing, and that's what really sustained me for quite a while. But yeah, I guess when I was a little kid, we'd go to the Saturday matinees and then come home and reenact them in the backyard. You know, bam, bam, gotcha, you know, hands up, Black Bart and that sort of thing, just playing as kids do and still do. I remember I was going, the Dukes had been on the air for a couple of years, and I had a little thing that I did on the CB that I would say, Breaker One, might be crazy, but I ain't dumb, crazy cooter coming at you. Y'all got your ears on? Well, now that was a little catchphrase of mine. And I used to play basketball every day in Verduga Park when I was out there filming in Burbank. And I was going over to the gym to play, jogging over there sort of. And there were a bunch of kids playing in a yard. And I hear one of them say, breaker one, might be crazy, but I ain't dumb, crazy cooter coming at you. And I thought, oh my, you know, it's like a deja vu of what I had done as a kid playing in the backyard. So to that generation, we were to them like Roy Rogers and Gene Autry and Hopalong Cassidy and all those heroes were to us. They would go out and emulate them and reenact the shows and everything. So that, and that to me is the great compliment. You know, that's the greatest compliment you can get, that you make people happy. And that's what our show did, and it still does.
That's a great story. How did you get the role of the mechanic on the series?
I had been in a film called The Moon Runners, which was written by a friend of mine in Atlanta. I worked out of Atlanta for 25 years, actually, and worked out of Atlanta during those years I was on the Dukes. Guy was a television director in Atlanta and a writer, and he put together a small independent film called The Moon Runners. And it was basically the same story as the Dukes of Hazzard, you know, two cousins, and they're pretty cousin, and they, you know, the law was crooked, and there was a boss hog character. And the music was done by Waylon Jennings for this movie, The Moon Runners. Low budget independent film. I had a small part in it. I did not play Cooter. A friend of mine did, in fact. But I played a revenueer trying to catch the Dukes. And so the film, I think that was about 1974 or 75. But then Guy Waldron, after that, went out to California and got the job as a screenwriter with Norman Lear and was writing things and pitching things on his own. And there came, what happened in the late 70s, you'll recall, Waylon and Willie were huge, the outlaw movement, they called it. And Burt Reynolds had done Smokey and the Bandit. I had a small part in that, too. It was a huge movie. Gigantic box office. And NASCAR was just really becoming America's sport. It was going far beyond the South and was becoming a TV hit every Sunday with Dale Earnhardt and Richard Petty and Cale Yarborough, great NASCAR drivers like that. And at the time, Jimmy Carter, a peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia, was the president of the United States. So Hollywood folks are looking around now for Southern things they could do and approach Guy about making, or he approached them about turning his film The Moon Runners into a television series. So in the fall of 1978, Warner Brothers and CBS came to right about where I live, about 20 miles from where I lived in Georgia, east of Atlanta, to film The Dukes of Hazzard. I think I was one of the first people cast in it. They knew my work. And so I just walked in, basically, and they said, you got the part. And so we started filming, and we filmed the first five episodes of The Dukes in east of Atlanta in the fall of 1978. And then as winter came in, colder weather, we said, we're going to take a break and come back here and do this another series of filming in the spring. But what happened was is that Warner Brothers loved what they were seeing. CBS really loved it and said, we got to do some more. Move this thing. Bring it out here to Hollywood. We'll just start filming immediately. So at the same time that we came on the air in January of 1979, we came on a Friday night. The following Monday, we started shooting, you know, the rest of the series, which went on for another seven seasons. Mm. So I was just in the right place at the right time, and the show was sort of what America wanted at that point in time. We never took ourselves seriously. It was just great fun.
There are
the ingredients of it are timeless, as we said. You know, the action, great action, and we had the best stunt guys and the best action ever filmed for television show. Not for films, you know, where they've got enormous budgets, but for a TV show. Those were real jumps with real drivers and real cars. And we also had the wonderful slapstick comedy, and that's classic. That's been around since the Greek and Roman theaters, the same jokes, you know. Guy slips on a banana peel and falls in a mud puddle. If the timing is right, it's funny, and we had great actors doing that. We had, you know, pretty girls, and the prettiest girl of all, Catherine Bach, playing Daisy Duke. And one of the best-selling posters in history. And we had great music. We had, besides Waylon Jennings, we had wonderful stars from Nashville coming in all the time. Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette and Buck Owens and people like that. So it was a great package, and it just worked. It still works.
It still does. Three of the cast members 40 years later are sadly no longer with us, but we've talked a little bit about them. But tell me what kind of people they were on the set, and let's start with Denver Pyle.
Well, again, ultimate professional who had, he came out of World War II and wanted to be an actor. He was from Colorado originally, but ended up in Hollywood. His brother was had a brother who was a cartoonist for Walt Disney, and Denver just had a wonderful career, and he always played older than he was. When he was in his 30s, he was playing, you know, guys who were in their 60s. He just had an old look, and when he grew that beard, which he had for years, but he'd had a wonderful, he'd worked a lot in the John Ford movies, you see him, and things like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and other movies like that. He was part of John Ford's sort of stock company, and he'd done Bonnie and Clyde. Everybody remembers him from that as the Texas Ranger, Frank Hamer, who captures them finally. And I'd seen him as on the Doris Day Show, on Grizzly Adams. So for me, it was work, and I'd always admired his work. One of those wonderful character actors that you've seen for years. Who's, you know, he worked all the time. He was also a TV director and directed a lot of things like Death Valley Days, those old westerns that they made in the 50s, the TV westerns, and he appeared in a lot of them. So he was kind of a mentor about film acting, as was James Best, who taught film acting. Jimmy had come out of World War II and become an actor and gone out there and been in all those westerns. So those guys knew each other from way back, and they knew all those great character actors, and they'd been in literally hundreds of westerns, both on the big screen and on television, and were just so experienced. Jimmy Best was really gifted. Denver, I'll finish up. He passed away on Christmas Day in 1997. He was 77 years old. And story about Denver. I was in a bookshop in Hollywood one time, and I saw a book about character actors, famous character actors. And Denver was in there, and it told the story. He had been in the Navy in World War II and had been on three ships that were sunk in the Pacific. And I asked him, I said, Denver, I saw this thing. I said, you never mentioned that. And he said, well, it wasn't something you want to talk about. Hmm. And that was Denver. He loved the West. He loved mules. He had mules. And was a great storyteller and a really solid actor. And he directed a lot of the shows. Jimmy Best... Jimmy was, again, a guy who had done a lot of westerns. I remember one western, I think it was that the left-handed gun with, it was filmed by, can't think of his name right away, but the guy who did Bonnie and Clyde. And, but it was Left-Handed Gun was about Billy the Kid. Paul Newman played Billy the Kid, and Jimmy Best was one of his sidekicks. And Denver Pyle was a deputy. And as I recall, Jimmy Best shot Denver in that movie. And then I guess Pat Garrett shot Jimmy. So, but anyhow, those are the guy to get. Obviously, I would be sitting in the middle of the night watching some old war movie, and all of a sudden, Denver jumps into the trench with Jimmy Best or something. They just had great careers.
Absolutely.
Saul was different. Saul was trained at the Yale School of Drama, and he went back. He did radio things, and he just had an incredible ear. And he taught, he sang opera, and he'd been a lot of Broadway shows and musicals and things like that. And but he was very gifted. In the Korean War, Saul had been in Army intelligence. He was brilliant. He spoke, I think, five or six languages fluently, including Mandarin Chinese. He was just, a polymath, as they say. He knew everything. And I'd heard a rumor that Saul was so smart that the CIA used him to break codes. And I thought, well, that's just an old wives' tale. But when I was a congressman in Washington, I checked into that, and they said, he worked for us. Wow. So Denver passed. He was 77 years old. They had great careers. And then Saul was the first that we lost in 1994. And I got to see him a lot right before he passed, and I treasure that. Jimmy Best... He was almost 89 years old and stayed with us and enjoyed the afterlife of the Dukes of Hazzard, as much as anybody. He was like a little kid. He just loved Roscoe P. Coltrane. Remember, he'd done hundreds and hundreds of films and television shows, and he taught. He was an acting teacher, and he was a, black belt in karate, and he was a writer and all these other things. But... again, he loved Roscoe as much as anything he ever did. It was a magic thing for all of us, I think. Sort of topped off our careers.
The series comes to an end in 1985, and then a reunion movie, I believe, late 90s, happens.
Well, we did two of them.
Two, I remember that, that's right.
Yeah, the first one, and we had lost Sorrel. So that sort of was a difficult thing, but it was fun just to get back together and have our good old time together. But the second one we did was really difficult because Denver was ill and everybody knew it, and he had cancer and. Was getting towards the end, so that sort of weighed heavily over the whole thing for all of us. But it's a trite cliche, but when you do something and are associated with people for as long as we've been associated together, the cast of the Dukes of Hazzard and the folks who worked on it, all of us feel like we're an extended family. And so that was tough for us, losing those guys. And but then, over the years... I think about 20 years ago, my wife Alma and I started doing this Cooters stuff thing. I thought it'd be a good idea, and I'd been in Congress, I'd gone back, and I'd done other movies, and I'd been in Los Angeles for a while doing that. And I just came back. I always wanted to live up here in the Blue Ridge Mountains, so we found a place here about 70 miles from Washington, D.C., but just sort of moved out here and joined the circus, sort of. And I had this idea for starting a little store called Cooters, which would be a Dukes of Hazzard, shop with all my old costumes and the car sitting out front and pictures from the show. And it turned out to be a good hunch because it just took off like a rocket, just like the show had back in 79. And people started coming from all over creation, and because they love the Dukes of Hazzard. So we now have three stores like that, and planning another one, which is yet to be announced. Not that far from Los Angeles, by the way. And we do these huge Dukes Fests, which have drawn One in Nashville a few years back drew 90,000 plus people over a couple of days. So it's, and people come from all over the world. And the other thing is, the other character from the show we should mention is the General Lee, which the most popular car in the history of television, which people build. You know, there are over 1,000 replica General Lees in the United States alone, and they're also in other countries. So, you know, it is, I've seen 250 of them at one time, and people just come rolling in. So the Dukes of Hazzard is alive and well, Scott, I'm telling you.
I know it. I'm glad to hear it. Politics. How did politics happen after the end of the series?
I lived in Georgia during the years we filmed, and I commuted to Los Angeles. And Georgia politics, I'd always had an interest in politics and government. And I'd been in college in the 1960s when it was all about politics. And as a Southerner, I was involved in the civil rights movement. I saw how getting involved in things like that could make a big difference in people's lives. We actually changed the United States of America and made it more fair and equitable, I think. But so I was an old Southern Democrat, and the governor of Georgia, through friends, I went to a barbecue for him and gave a talk for him, and sure enough, I just had a knack for it. And I'd campaigned for Jimmy Carter in 1980, and when the Dukes was incredibly popular. He lost that race, but anyhow, I'd gotten a little taste of it, and a few years later, in 1986, just after the Dukes had ended, I was asked if I'd be interested in running for Congress. Now, I'm sort of the last person who would, because there's another part of my life which we haven't touched on. But in 1977, about a year before the Dukes of Hazzard began filming, I was nearly killed myself from alcoholism. There's another part of my life. I'd been successful as an actor in those years, and I kept on working, but my own self-destructiveness and having that disease was taking me down. And so I got sober. But in all those years, I'd lived a really wild life, including a lot of fights and divorces and jailings and one thing or another. So, but, you know, almost 10 years had passed, and I was asked to run for Congress. And I said, well, you know, I really can't, because of I've got more bones in my closet than the Smithsonian Institute. The people say, you know, that could be an asset. You just tell the truth. You know, you're honest about that stuff and just get up and, you know, and the difference, you know, you had nothing but positive things and good things happen for 10 years now. So talk about that. And I did, and it was a race in 1986 against an incumbent who was thought to be unbeatable, and I almost won. And so I just kept on running, and 2 years later I won the seat. So it was kind of a pretty remarkable thing, from a low-bottom alcoholism to the halls of Congress, you know, just a decade or so later. And so that's the really remarkable thing about my life, other than this other stuff, was that from where I was in 1977 to going to Congress in 1988, it was just a miraculous thing, in my opinion.
In those days, in the 80s and 90s, when you were in Congress, what was it like?
Well, it was an interesting time. Not as, I think, politics now. We're in a serious situation in this country. There seems to be no middle ground. There's no room for compromise. There's nobody sitting down and saying, how can we just find a common sense solution? There's just, politics are polarized now. It was to a certain extent then, but there was always comity, you know, C-O-M-I-T-Y. That just means people getting along, and there was comity there. Even though that the schisms were there, and there were, you know, partisan people on both sides. There were also a whole lot of us who would get together and play basketball two or three times a week, Republicans and Democrats, and make friends and respect each other. I don't see that now. And in fact, I think that the Democratic Party has drifted far to the left and is being pulled that way by special interests. And the Republican Party has reacted and gone more to the right. And there's nobody representing the great center of America, you know, the great middle ground of compromise and common sense. So I don't know what the future holds, but I'm not sanguine about the future, as they say.
It was interesting because a few years ago we had the issue with the Confederate flag, and during that, the Dukes of Hazzard came up in conversations all across the country. What did you make of that conversation and taking
down?
Well,
that situation still exists to a much more difficult and divisive point right now, and I've been smack in the middle of it down here because, you know, well, you know, race is the great thing in our country. It's always that sore thing. It's embedded in our history, and the Civil War is the crucible of American history. And I'm a Southerner. I mean, of several, I've got African blood and American Indian blood in me, but all of my people, every one of them, all of my great grandfathers and great great grandfathers, all of them fought for the South, and very, very few of them owned slaves, and some of them had come out of slavery themselves. So it's a complex issue, and this wasn't a problem. The Dukes of Hazzard featured the rebel battle flag, which is a Christian cross of St. Andrew, the Scottish flag, on top of the General Lee. These boys were old Southern boys from out in the country. And this is, you know, remembered 25 years after the Civil Rights Movement. And yet there was no controversy whatsoever about the Dukes of Hazzard. There was certainly no racism in Hazzard County. The Dukes were colorblind, and the show was colorblind, and it had a huge African-American audience, particularly in the South. So, you know, and I knew that when I ran for Congress, I ran with enormous black support from the district, and my office in those days was about a block from where Dr. King is buried in what is now called the King District of Atlanta, and there was never even a question about that. So I think this is this doesn't come from the culture. Blacks and whites in the South have shared a culture and a common heritage for hundreds of years, and of work and weather and friendships and family bonds and religion and music and food and all those things we've shared as Southerners, the language. So this is political. This is and to me, as one who was involved in the Civil Rights Movement, and who, you know, I was shot at, and I was sucker punched, and had ammonia thrown in my eyes, and went to jail, and all those things. I see this, what's going on now, as the antithesis of the Civil Rights Movement. This isn't bringing people together, as Dr. King preached. You know, he said, "I have a dream that someday on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will dine together at the table of brotherhood." I mean, this is, and we were doing that. We were coming together, and enormous progress has been made. And this is setting that back. This is turning good-hearted people against good-hearted people.
It's interesting. I was going through some of the notes this morning, and it had said that during Bill Clinton's issue with an intern, that you had broken with the Democratic Party and called for his impeachment.
Well, that's right.
Why was that important for you?
I think because in that case, he lied, and he lied, and he lied, and he lied. And at a certain point, the American people, you know, they castigated. Their first reaction was political. If Bill Clinton had come out and said, you know, I want to apologize to my family, to my Mrs. Clinton, to everybody in America because I have made a terrible mistake. If he had just told the truth, if he had fessed up, he would now be remembered in an entirely different way as an honorable guy. But this first reaction was not only to lie and deny that anything had taken place, but to attack the girl. I had been involved in the Clinton campaign and had worked with him. And this Jennifer Flowers thing had come up. Now, it turns out, years later, it turns out that that was absolutely true. Yet he had not only, during the campaign, it came up, and, you know, in fact, I was on a conference call where it's just that she's, you know, trailer trash, they were saying. And I can't believe anything this woman says. Well, it was true. And it would have been so much simpler and easier, and in the long run, far more noble to simply tell the truth. Yeah, I got out, and when I told the truth about my own life, and it was not a pretty picture, people said, good for you, you know. There's nothing wrong. It's liberating. But he wouldn't do that, and everybody knew what was going on. So I just said, listen, if you're not going to just stand up and tell the truth, that what happened then, I think it cost them, certainly in retrospect, I'm an independent now, so which is a very liberating thing too. But it cost Al Gore the presidency because we spent a whole year talking about Bill Clinton's shenanigans, you know, and his private parts, not only, and et cetera. That was the news for an entire year. It controlled, you know, that whole impeachment process and all that. And, you know, it still lingers today when people talk about Bill Clinton, who was such a gifted guy. I'd known him before he was even running when he was governor of Arkansas. But, you know, I felt like, well, somebody just got to step up and say it because the Democrats were afraid and it had become a partisan issue. The truth should not be a partisan issue. So that was my point on it. You know, just come on, step up and either tell the truth or get out of there. That brought the country down. I think it did. And I think Al Gore said it damaged him terribly in his race.
I think you're right about that. As an independent in 2018, 10 years later, oddly enough, what do you make of the current president as an independent?
As an independent, you know, as I've expressed my concern already about the polarization of American politics, but this guy is one of a kind, sui generis, as they say, that taught us in Latin class. There's never been a president like Trump before, and I think what he has done is capitalize on the mood of the times, the zeitgeist, whatever. You know, we've had all these years of television game shows and celebrity headbutts and all that stuff, and here he is, a totally unconventional politician who actually won. Nobody thought he was going to be elected, except maybe his own pollsters. So it was a surprise. But to me, he's the president of the United States. And I think his behavior, I think he needs to modify. Cut the tweets out, cut the personal attacks out, take the high road, learn to be a diplomat, a diplomat in all things, and continue to go with your instincts. Just to slightly a more mature style would serve him better. Just right now, if this thing between North and South Korea were to come to some agreement, if North Korea were to denuclearize, if the Korean War were actually to come to an end and there was some repatriation going on there, just a beginning towards that, he should get the Nobel Peace Prize. That's an astonishing and remarkable thing he's done and that they've accomplished. The economy is in great shape. So, you know, you got to give him credit where credit is due. But I'm afraid that the left, and when I say that, I include the major media in the country, the major networks, with the exception of Fox, which is, I guess, a major network, and the major newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the L.A. Times, any of them you can find, Northeastern academia, and the Hollywood community are all determined all day long to attack and try to impeach Donald Trump. Meanwhile, he's out there with, I guess, his popularity is about the same, and he won the election. It's important that people understand that, and he won it playing by the rules. So you got to respect that. I don't know Trump, but I do understand the presidency as a student of history, and I think that he's got to be given his chance. Now, he's imposed a style on this that is polarizing, that doesn't help bring people together. But I'm afraid that's just the way he is and is going to be. So it'll be interesting to watch. I would give him a check mark so far. It's been a roller coaster ride for him, but he's still riding high, and I don't think he's lost any popularity against and he's running against the media establishment, which is difficult to do. So I don't know. I'd give him a C+ or B-.
With about 2 minutes left here, I'll throw a few questions at you. Would you ever run for office again?
No, I have a couple of things. My politics are just too independent now. I'm just plain ornery. And, so I am an independent, and I try to see things in as balanced a way as possible and say what I think. But I'm also going to be 77 years old in August, and I've had, four total knee replacements and a back degeneration and hip replacement. I broke a hip last year. I'm just getting old. I'm paying for all those car wrecks back in Hazard County and all that football I played when I was a kid, I guess. But I have the happiest life of anybody I know. And, I speak my piece in politics, but as a candidate, no. I do support people occasionally and help them out, but I'm just happily retired from politics.
Are you still there?
Yeah, okay. I'm here.
As an independent who speaks his piece, did you have a favorite in 2016 in the presidential election?
Actually, I ended up, and my old Democratic pals look aghast at this, but with those choices, which I thought, how in a country of 320, 30 million people can we come up with these two choices? I voted for Donald Trump because the attacks upon my culture that are coming from the left, and the attacks on our show, and the attacks on my people, my grandparents, my family, attacks on the South. And this is real to us down here. I've spent my lifetime trying to bring people together, and these people are just merrily tearing things apart, taking down, statues of revered Americans who were, in their time, did exactly what they thought was right. This deserves another conversation. There's a reaction here, and it's an honest reaction, and it's not a mean-spirited reaction. It's a heartfelt reaction.
And nothing wrong with that. And 100 years from now, because I'm sure Dukes of Hazzard will still be running.
We'll still be here.
Yeah, still be, without question. How would you like them to look back on you?
Oh, that I was just part of a happy show, a good time. Our show makes people feel good. It brings families together. It makes little children smile. It brings tears to people. It means a lot to people. Our silly old crazy show, still going strong all over the world. And I think they're, just like I remember Gene Autry and Roy Rogers. They were good old boys.
Well, Ben, this was your first visit, but I think I would love to have those conversations on the Confederate flag and things being under attack. So I hope it's not your last visit, and I hope you come back often because it's been a lot of fun today. You made
well,
me
I feel the same, Scott. Thank you so much. It was a great way to spend some time, and you asked great questions.
Well, thank you, and we'll be in touch.
Give me a holler.
You stay well. Bye-bye.
I'm down and I'm gone. Thank you.
Ben Jones. Very good. For this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.